Yeah. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Woman on Word podcast. I am your host, Alyssa Askins.
And I am your host, Jillian Drappola. And we're your not too average museum gals, just talking history, drinking, and slinging some jokes.
This week, what was it? Last week's episode, we weren't drinking because I was driving home from Virginia Beach. But that is not stopping me this week because I got wine. I'm magically really wishing and manifesting that it becomes Witch's Brew because, this is our two-part episode. And the night with it. But, Jill, what are you drinking?
Well, I just finished a workout, so I'm going to go and get myself a bottle of Witch's Brew because that's a thing. So we're doing it, and it was a hard day at work, so we're going to do it and talk about some badass women in history. Let's go.
Yeah, I'm so sad because I really am, wishing I had Witch's Brew. God damn it, Virginia, get your crap together.
Here we go. I'm gonna have Witch's Brew. We're going to do the spiced apple version.
I hope you know Jillian just literally showed our wonderful guest Rachel Boss and I the bottle of this Witch's Brew, and it's a new one that I've never had, and now I'm
get your fruits, friends. Get them in there no matter how. No, I'm kidding. Drink responsibly.
Well, anyway, as you know, this is our two-part, as you said. We have our awesome guest, Rachel Bach. And Rachel, are you drinking, herbal tea, drinking some water, staying hydrated? What are you drinking today?
I am drinking some water. And Alyssa, I am right there with you because the Witch's Brew came out with this new flavor as soon as I found out that I was pregnant, and made me really, really sad. So I've got a bottle, and I'm waiting until, I can drink again, and I am sure I will enjoy it. So
I am so sure. This is, as we're waiting for Jill to get her, pour her Witch's Brew. When Jillian came down, in September, she brought down, a couple bottles for me. And I was so happy. And then my best friend, Missy, had literally somehow magically figured out how to send Witch's Brew to me, through the mail. And I ended up having, 5 more bottles. So I had probably about a total of 7 to 8. And I was very happy. Jill and I can drink one or two when she's there. I don't remember. But then came October, and I was like, oh, no, I'm almost out of Witch's Brew. And Mama White came to the rescue when she came down. And so it's just fitting, everybody. If you don't know what Witch's Brew is, I suggest that you get it. But it's fitting for the night witches. So, Rachel, if you can, please give our awesome listeners a recap as to who the night witches were, what they were doing. And, that's just really the synopsis of the Witch's Brew.
The night witches?
The night witches for Witch's Brew.
Sorry, everybody. We are on something else. Yes, we've not texted with our
connect with us. There we go.
Yes. Okay, so for everyone who hasn't listened to the last episode yet, I suggest going back and listening to the whole podcast while you're there. But if you don't have time and you're like, shut up, lady, don't ever come back on this podcast again because you talk way too much. Brief synopsis. The Night Witches were formed in 1941. Marina Raskova was kind of like the founder. She petitioned Stalin to let women into the Air Force because women were able to join the army but not be pilots. But the Soviet Union, being as progressive as they were, had an abundance of already trained female pilots because of different flying clubs. So the Night Witches were formed. There were 3 different regiments. The 586, the 587, and the 588. The 588 was the one that was dubbed the Night Witches, that actually earned the nickname. They were the Night Bombers. And they were an all-woman regiment. Mechanics, crew, navigators, pilots, armors, they were all women, which was something that was really unique, which is really cool. So all of these women, they basically made a name for themselves. They faced discrimination from the men because they were women. They got kind of the short end of the stick when it came to different materials. Their planes were called PO2s. They were made for farming and, you know, like crop dusting and training. They weren't meant to be combat. They were biplanes. They were super old. You know, all of the men were flying these beautiful, sleek fighter pilot, you know, fighter jets. And here they were in wooden planes covered in canvas, just kind of tutting along. But they were expected to do their thing. So they would fly night missions because they were slow planes and really rattly, and they couldn't outfly German planes. So they had to use the cover of night, which in Russia, you know, not a bad thing because it's dark there a lot. Like half the year, it's dark most of the time. And so they would be able to fly multiple missions, you know, average 10 missions a night. But sometimes I've read all the way up to 18 missions were completed if they had a station that was close by where they were bombing. They would bomb supply trains. They would bomb, you know, train stations, different things like that. But, you know, in the off time, they would also drop food for Soviet forces, medical supplies, things like that. So basically wherever they were needed. But their claim to fame, which is funny because the Germans actually nicknamed them Nachtexen, which is night witches in German, because they were so terrified of them, because they came out of nowhere and they were strategic. And yeah, I think that just about sums up where we left off last week.
I was, as you're saying, like Nachtexen, and this was just coming from me being a fluent speaker of German and also knowing that German can be a very scary language. I think it's really funny that they call them, now that I think about it, that they call them Nachtexen, because if you think about an angry German yelling Nachtexen, like it's said type of fear. I can't even do it because I'm just going to laugh really hard. So just imagine, like, it would be like the Nachtexen because it's plural, and just imagine an angry German just screaming it, just going crazy. Like,
Nachtexen! Oh my god!
Oh my god! Oh my god! Just like screaming and freaking out everywhere.
Basically. I don't know.
It's mind-boggling that they call them the night witches, but as you mentioned last week, though, too, it's because the way they're playing when they turn off the engine, right, it sounds like a witch's broom.
Yeah.
So now I want to hear that sound. I really want to. I might go down the YouTube rabbit hole tonight. It might happen.
Maybe. I'd be like, oh, let me get like a bunch of reenactor friends together, but like I only know someone who owns like a P, like, 38 Mustang, like an American plane. So like some people in the reenacting community have like way too much money, and like, what do you do? Help a girl out. Cause I'd be like, oh, we can create that sound. But like, yeah, there's not like many people who do like Russian reenacting. But Rachel, last week we were talking, like before we started like recording, but how did they, like, who rigged the bombs? Was it female riggers or?
Yes. So there was female armorers, and they would attach all of the different bombs by hand. Like, they didn't have machines, you know, if they couldn't even get radios and navigation in the airplanes, they're not going to have machines to load the bombs for you. So all of the women were doing that themselves, like by hand, you know. I can't even imagine the stress that put on the body. And then also too, you know, if anything malfunctioned, because it's an old crappy plane, which it's bound to have some sort of, you know, lack of better terms, technical difficulties. A lot of times, if the pilot was flying without a navigator, they would have to go out on the wing themselves and like manually drop the bomb. Again, that's if they're not flying with a navigator, which was very uncommon. Most of the time, it was a two-person plane, because remember, these planes were for training purposes. So the front seat would be for the pilot, and then the back seat would be for the trainer, which is very convenient because that's where the navigators would be able to sit. So the navigators would go out on the wing itself and pull the pin, drop the bomb, get back, and keep going.
That's first of all, that's incredible that they would do that. Secondly, that's like the epitome of hold my beer.
Yes.
Just want to put that out there. No one will ever have a better hold my beer than that.
That's a hard flex, for sure.
Yeah. Seriously.
Again, the world. Girls.
Girls.
Yeah. That's right. Even with their bodies, though, I know we briefly touched on this in last week, too. It really, especially those who are in, like, that armor type role, it really transformed their bodies, though, right? I don't even know. Do you know the weight of the bombs off the top of your head? How much do they weigh?
So the bombs were roughly, I did have this. Roughly about 400 pounds. 200 pounds, and there was four of them. That's where it is. 200 pounds, there was four of them on each plane, and so you were working roughly with 800 pounds per plane.
And how many planes do they have to load per night?
It depends on how much you're working with, how close you were to the mission site. So if the planes would be in constant rotation and they were flying back, you know, every 20 minutes or so and rearming themselves, they would be working all night long.
I mean, one plane would have about 10, most on average would be 10 runs. So that would be, Jesus, that's like 8,000 pounds just for one plane. And armor, I guess, not necessarily division, but armor component to that regiment would have to. Well, that is insane.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's like the ultimate CrossFit.
Yeah.
That is, yeah, really.
It puts everything to shame. Everything to shame. Pilates, I mean, CrossFit, you like, name it. Like,
After hearing like those numbers, it makes sense as to why a lot of the women who were in these units didn't wear pants, didn't wear skirts. Like, they, you know, stayed at home. They stayed in, like, if you want to call it, like, the quote unquote, like, womanly roles, like, after this, because they're just like, I did my part for the greater good. I mean, it's like, if you talk to any like World War II veteran, like stateside or anything, they're like, we did our part because we had to do our part. But, you know, I don't think, like, an American woman really had to do what the Russian women did.
I think you're really onto something with that, too. Because, you know, we kind of touched on it last episode. The women in the United States still had that kind of freedom to express their femininity. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the Soviet Union, everyone was expected to be uniform. Everyone was treated, you know, more or less similar to each other. And since we spoke last week and up until this week, I, you know, digging a little bit more and trying to find, you know, anything to kind of correlate the two. And the best thing I could find was, you know, because they were so uniform, they found ways to let their femininity show through throughout the war. So like the navigators, the pencils that they used, they would like double as eyeliner, or, you know, they found different ways to express themselves so that they didn't lose themselves completely. I mean, they still had to wear the same trousers and the, you know, the flight shirts and the flight jackets and all of that stuff, wool stockings as the men did. And a lot of times they didn't fit as well as the men did because they were men's clothes.
Right.
But they definitely tried to help themselves through the process of the war by picking up those little things. They would sing and dance with each other, and it, you know, I thought the eyeliner was something that really stood out to me, because, you know, even though we're women and we're in the middle of a war, doesn't mean we have to lose everything of ourselves. And a lot of these women too, like, you have to remember, were really young. They started the war as girls, and, you know, there were not a whole lot that were over the age of 30. You know, most of them were college students or came from farms or signed up because they lost a loved one, you know, a brother or a sweetheart or something. And so they came into the war very green, which is why I also think that that helped them to find those little things so that they didn't lose themselves completely.
I mean, that one little thing of eyeliner, I think, is something, I mean, hope is one of the biggest things that you can possibly have that can get you through anything. And that was kind of one of their little symbols. And I know women here, and even in the Royal Air Force specifically, their thing was, I mean, it's still iconic today, but their lipstick. If you think about it, you know, that was something, especially if they were pilots or anything of that nature. I mean, actually, I think all throughout the war, like, we're going to get into a more deeper level because so many things were rationed. But if a woman had lipstick on, that was something that allowed her to just have that sense of femininity and not really lose herself. And I think that is something that is so incredible, especially coming from women who are in a country at the time of the Soviet Union where they're all about collectivism. And that's why, you know, they had to do these things and why they wanted to do it. I mean, the United States, I will say, at that point, would have been relatively collective, right? Because that's why they're known as the greatest generation. But women still at least had the skirts and the dresses for their, especially if they were officers, you know, for their officer right. uniform. Or if they were even cryptographers who, I know I touched base that if they were posted in an abandoned building in Paris, they still could wear their skirts and their, you know, not necessarily pumps per se, but just those simple things, I think, really carry them through, especially if their bodies really transformed, like you had said before, you know, they were muscular beyond all belief. I mean, for one plane, if they're all lifting 8,000 pounds just for one plane that did 10 runs, like, that, your body is going to go through some major changes. And I know you also said, Rachel, too, that some of them couldn't even, after the war, they couldn't conceive. And so
right.
that, especially that generation, you know, family, that's something that they grew up with. You know, we have that freedom now where we can really choose if we want to have children as women. But back then, that was just the norm. And so I wonder what type of psychological effect that had on them after the war specifically.
And I just want to, like, add in, too, for our listeners who, because we have a very, like, female-heavy listener base, but, like, for the males who are listening, we appreciate you guys, but also, like, at this time in World War II, it was expected that you had children. It wasn't mm-hmm. just, like, this, you know, it was, like, expected. It was, like, when are you going to have children? And for them to not be able to conceive, like, I'm sure that, you know, posed a lot of, I don't, you know, it messed with them a little bit, I'm sure, and it made them feel, I don't want to say like the equivalent of like the men who were 4F'd, but I mean I've read stories where women who just said that they've felt like they've failed, like as a wife, as, you know, a woman, because they couldn't conceive.
Right. And then also too, on the opposite end of the spectrum, so the women who couldn't conceive, like, that was a really big issue. But then also, too, the women who were maybe just out of university and had husbands and had started families. I touched on a book that I had read about accounts, firsthand accounts, oral histories of women who fought in the World War II for the Soviet Union. In the same book, I read an account of a woman who had a daughter, and her husband died at the front, and she ended up leaving her daughter with her husband's family and became a pilot. So that, like, adversely, from the woman who couldn't conceive, you know, the woman who did have families or children, or at least a child, you know, what kind of psychological and emotional scarring did that take if they did so choose to leave and go fight in the front?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I understand completely, like, well, not completely, because, like, I'm not a mom, but, you know, I'm sure I am agreeing with everything that you're saying.
Yeah. You can definitely be sympathetic towards how they were feeling.
Yeah.
Which is crazy to me to think about. You know, with me becoming a mom, like, I would not want to leave.
Yeah.
You know, here, I don't know if I'm going to be coming back, but here's my child, and please take care.
Yeah.
Yes. No thanks.
And speaking, and, oh, go ahead, Alyssa.
Oh, I was just thinking, it's just another testament, not just, you know, the American side is known as, that there was some reason, but really, I think that a true testament to the Allied spirit at the time of that, in a way, these countries who are so individualistic, and women who were so, I don't want to say necessarily individualistic at that point, but women were really coming into their own during this war. And for them to have that sense to leave their child behind, I mean, if I'm going to be quite frank, like, that would be me, that I would have done that, because to be a part of something like that and to have that sense of duty, which we already know I've tried before, but to have that sense of duty is to do that, and to know, to not even go in and know what is going to happen, especially if you already have a child and you're like, oh, well, I've already had a child before, I can conceive after the war, but then what if you couldn't? Once again, like, what if you, I mean, even as pilots, your body has to go through so much rigorous training. You have to be so physically fit to be a pilot, not just even mentally and emotionally. You have to be that, just all around mental toughness. I'm truly just wondering, just even the effect that had on them just in general, was to be that mental toughness, which we all joke around, and most people joke around about mother nature being so mentally tough and all this other stuff. But really, like, what these women did and what they went through is something I feel like we, as three women who are also historians, this is just barely kept on the surface. And, like, there's so much deeper level stuff to it. But that's just my take.
No, I think also, too, you said something that really sparked something. Like, women are really coming into their own at this time. And that, I mean, that's really prominent even from the woman who started these regiments, you know, Marina Raskova. She rose to fame before the war even started. She was basically the Soviet Union's equivalent to Amelia Earhart. She and two other women actually were the first women to receive the Hero of the Soviet Union medal before the war, before the Soviet Union actually entered the war. She was doing trying to do a straight line flight. And her plane went down, and, you know, she had a parachute, thank goodness, and landed safely and was living on rations for 10 days. But, like, it's something that women were starting to do more and more and more. You know, this is like the late 1930s, and she ultimately, you know, talked to Stalin, basically. She petitioned him. She was like, listen, all of these women are, you know, we have good pilots, and we've got all of these women who are willing to come in and willing to be a part of something greater than themselves. Let us have it. And, you know, the rest is history. And out of the Night Witches Regiment, 22 of them won Hero of the Soviet Union medal, which is the highest honor that you can receive. And I mean, it was well deserved. Some of them, like, single pilots would fly over 800 missions before the war had ended. You know, flying 800 missions, that's in just a short amount of time, you know, just a couple of years.
Especially the equipment that they had, you know, it wasn't like, if we're going to go back to the American plane, like a 251 Russia and a 238, they had wooden blades with canvas.
Yeah.
And it's incredible. And I'm going to say it again, literally, who runs the world?
Yeah. Girls. But like, I just want to throw it in there too. You know, for those of you who are listening, just to put it in perspective for you, the Russians were giving these women medals before, during, and after the war. To give you a comparison, it's the WASP. They weren't even recognized as a military unit. They were volunteers. They weren't civilians, but they weren't military. They were just kind of like this transport service that was just kind of like there, and they didn't really know what to do with them, but it freed up the men to go fight in the war. They were not even recognized until Obama was president. Like, they couldn't even get buried in Arlington National Cemetery because they were not recognized as a veteran of World War II. I mean, there are women in photographs that are finally recognized as a military unit, like Obama's first term. And that's when the first WASP was buried in Arlington, just to give you perspective.
Yeah.
I'm going to say it louder for the people in the back.
And Marina Raskova, when she died, I mean, she ultimately died what she loved doing, which was flying. Her plane crashed while she was attempting to a forced landing. And she was actually the very first person, not just woman, the very first person to receive a state funeral during the war. And her ashes are buried in the Kremlin Wall Necropolis. Like, full honors, totally recognized for everything that she did, all of her accomplishments. So that's pretty cool.
That is amazing. I think it's really cool that they honored the Russian women before, during, and after the war compared. I mean, it just shows you like how collective the Russian populace really was, because they're like, this is for one whole war effort, where you look at like the American side of it and they're like, everything is for the war effort. Yes. But they still had, can I say, segregation, like, between the sexes? Like, you know, the WASP are doing, you know, this, but they weren't military, but they weren't, you know, civilian. Or you look at, you know, the WACS, the Women's Army Corps, who were, like, just, like, clerks, and they did, you know, secretary roles. Like, they were still helping out in a way, but they were still kind of restrained to, like, women's roles. You know, they weren't necessarily... I mean, you could equate these women to fighter pilots.
Right, yeah, they were definitely classified as combat.
Combat.
Which is something that we don't see coming from the United States.
Wine. But yeah,
it's fine. Drinking.
Fighter pilots, combat pilots.
It really is, though. It's complete and total. I'm going to say it. It's bullshit. It is so much bullshit that, going back to the WASP, they were not even considered military, like, veterans until almost, what, 70, 73 years after the war?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
63 years after the war, excuse me. I can't do math.
It's fine. But you're drinking,
we're historians.
Too. We're drinking, too. It's fine.
You still should be able to add years.
I know.
But it was like, let's see. Like, whether it be, like, 1 year to, like, 73 years, that is too long for these women to go unrecognized, because they gave props to, like, oh yeah, women worked in the factories, and like women were WASP, or they were nurses, or they were in the Navy, or they were, you know, whatever. But then you have women who are literally towing targets for live shooting practice, and they would get sabotaged by rags being stuffed in their engines, sugar literally put in the gas tank, and they got like no recognition for it. And you know, it was looking at the Americans versus the British versus the Russians, like, it was all basically the same program. It was the same thing, you know, except for the British and American are like, well, we're going to free up the men to go fight. And the women are like, we're just going to go and do it with you guys. I think that's still absolutely absurd that it took so long for them to be formally recognized.
With you on that.
Yeah.
It's definitely something to even touch base on. And I mean, this kind of goes into, I guess, kind of almost a somewhat segment for next week. But when it comes to warfare and looking at women's roles, I will definitely say that the Russians truly paved the way for women to really get into those more of those combat, I guess, well, yeah, more of those combat roles. I mean, even up until Vietnam, I think women were still in those roles. They were still a nurse or still a secretary. And the Russians really paved it. But even looking at women really in Paris, in Belgium, in Holland, even in Germany, all throughout Eastern Europe, women put themselves in harm's way for really, I mean, just in a lot of ways, both causes because of espionage. But Jesus freaking Christ, like, look at Sophie Scholl. If any of you who don't know who Sophie Scholl is, she was a 21-year-old. She was 21 years old, and so she was a university student who was in the resistance, and she put herself in line, and she would ride her bicycle with all these pamphlets for the resistance. And so many young females did that, but yet it's history, his story, literally.
Yeah.
And it is so mind-boggling because women truly put themselves in harm's way all throughout every single war. It doesn't matter if it's modern warfare, but the knock hacks in the night witches really are the ones who, you know, even you have the resistance, they're truly the ones who really did put themselves in harm's way with their planes, their lack of safety. Did they even have parachutes, Rachel? Do you know if they had parachutes or no?
So some of them did. not all of them had parachutes, yep. You know, which is so here's the thing. So if like the higher, like Marina Raskova, you know, like the higher ranking officials, they would have had parachutes. But some of the lower ranking, you know, just the pilots, because these planes didn't really reach a great elevation, they're flying low to the ground and they, you know, were very slow. They were like, eh, you'll be fine.
I feel like that's very Russian. Like, if we make it, we make it. If we don't, we don't. But you don't have a parachute, so you better make it back.
Right. Which I think I said in the last episode is, like, one of the accounts that I read, this woman literally flew her plane into their air station, and the whole bottom part of the plane was on fire. You know, if they get hit by a tracer bullet, they're going up in flames.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, done.
I wish viewers could literally see my face right now. This is something, I mean, as Julian said, it is very Russian. Again, it's the only thing you make it. Okay. But even so, even if they were lower enlisted, they were not granted a parachute because I would assume that the man would be getting death. And it's like, oh, well, I'm not needed. And you're just like,
what?
These women are literally putting themselves in harm's way with the, you know, I always forget what the equivalent of a P-51 Mustang was for the Germans. I can't remember for the life of me. But the Luftwaffe was so notorious that they could easily just shoot down a plane like that. And at some point or another, you're not going to have very many female pilots if that was the case, if you didn't have that training or anything along those lines. And even today, you know, women, what was it, five years ago, women in the United States could finally go into combat arms units. I mean, there's still a long way to go. However, I'm going to say it, and I don't care. It should not take that long. It should never take that long because women have proven time and time again, especially when going back to the night witches, have proven that women are more than capable. I mean, I would assume because it is Soviet Russia that the standards for men and women would have been the same, especially because of the armor, the women who were doing the armor component. It had to have been the same. And that is proof right there that women can do it.
Yeah.
Like I'm 5'3" for everybody who doesn't know, and I could fireman carry my husband, who is 6'1", like close to 200 pounds, if I truly needed to. Like if we were battle buddies, I could easily do it because adrenaline and all this other stuff. And that just, yeah, that makes me so mad.
Yeah, and like to kind of piggyback off that, I have 2 points to make here. So like one, I can only imagine the Night Witches, like first of all, like you hear, you know, the sirens going off, like call to planes sort of thing. And you have, so you, one, you know, your night raid's starting. Two, the amount of adrenaline going through you is probably insane, but also the amount of patriotism that is, of course, like it's just building upon each other over and over and over again. And to piggyback off of like, you know, women become like just recently becoming able to go into combat units. I've spoken to many friends in the reenacting community who are ex-military. And, you know, I've brought up that point where it's like, they say that women the day after, you know, sorry guys, we're talking about this, but the day after their menstrual cycle, they are literally the most level-headed person. Science has proven that women, the day after their cycle ends, their hormones are so balanced that they are the most, they can take on any situation, basically, and handle it. And I think that's incredible. Like, that is amazing. So I was like, get women in there who are, like, able to be snipers, at least, or whatever. And so the guys have literally told me that it wouldn't work in a combat setting. Because if a woman is in their unit, and I've seen this in reenacting, it's happened to me because I am friends with so many guys that they kind of like adopt me like from resistance into like part of their unit sort of thing, where they're like, we, you know, feel like we have responsibility for you. And I'm like, but then if something happens like in a reenactment, even in a reenactment, not even a combat situation, they will come to me first and not focus. I'm like, focus, what are you doing? Like, look at that. And so it's the equivalent to being in modern warfare, not like a reenactment, but like the same setting. Like they said that they would think of that woman in the combat unit as a sister and look out for her well-being first, which could ultimately put the entire unit in jeopardy. And so I'm like, but you don't have to. It's just like, I feel like it's just like a natural male response to have that happen. And I'm just like, you don't have to. And so like, I've kind of snuck away from some of the groups, like in reenactments, because I'm like, I'm going to have to go on like off on my own right now, because you're naturally gravitating towards me. And I need you to focus on what you're doing. And I can't even imagine it in like a World War II like setting.
It's definitely more so like if we are going to touch base on that subject, because I've had to do so many research studies on it for women in combat energy units. Yes, it's true, men will naturally gravitate for the woman. It's just a biological component. Yeah. However, when you go through your basic training, everybody is relatively not by standards, because military standards are different between men and women. But you are collectively whole unit, like you look out for everybody.
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting that component changes. But to touch base on snipers, Russia also had female snipers.
Yes, they did.
Russian and Finnish women. Like, Russia, I can't believe it. Like, Russia, go.
And they were badass too.
We go to Russia because Rachel and Jillian know how much the next day they went to Olympic. Seriously, but that's just, it's once again another proof that women are so capable of doing this. Once again, the Russian women, the women of World War II really showcase that so much. Confining women to those gendered roles and just strictly espionage, I think, is totally unjust in so many ways. Like I said, time and time again, women just have proven that they can do it. Now, if you are facing warfare, yes, you have a lot of those biological components that kick in terms of like why some people are against women today being in combat arms units. It's understandable.
Yeah.
But truly, when it comes down to it, in any setting, you have your mission. Mm-hmm. You treat everyone like basically a brother. And that's what gets you through, because there are other females. I don't know. I don't think if I actually know any females that are combat arms units. I know a lot of them that are pilots, that are tenant pilots and Black Hawk pilots. But even then, that is still such a boys club, but they still treat them with the same amount of respect, and they look at them as if they are one. I think that's just, I'm going to be completely honest, it is a social support piece. But yes, it's biology, but your mind can overcome those biological impulses as long as you can properly train it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, I think on, and I, you know, touching, you know, kind of jumping in without jumping in, because you guys know way more about that than I do. But I think that that's what made the Night Witches so unique and so successful was that they were an all women regiment. Yeah. You know, they all looked at each other like sisters, you know, like you said, you know, you're looking out for your brother next to you. You're looking out for your sister next to you. They were all women. So they didn't have, to worry about, you know, necessarily to Jillian's point of like being looked after or, protected. They were all worried about protecting each other.
Mm-hmm. I'm touching my nose, and that is like, yes, I agree with you, and I have something else, so I need to remind myself of what it is. I picked it up when I worked in Sequoia. But that's another interesting point that you made yourself about. They were all women. So in today's military, in our military today, there is something called FET, and they are called, what it stands for, female engagement team. So the female engagement teams go out with combat arms units, specifically like into areas of like Afghanistan where women cannot talk female, right? You know, there is a very divided culture between men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And so in female engagement teams, when they go out, they are able to talk to the women and kind of so far and so forth. And that's where, in my personal opinion, that's where we need to be collectively. If you're not going to integrate women fully, then you need to up the sets, and you need to create them to be stronger, but also give them the same standards, right? Because once again, the Night Witches more than likely have the same standards as male. Just up with the snipers, because it is Soviet Russia.
Right.
Activism.
Yes, absolutely.
They have the same standards, but they didn't get to reap the same rewards.
And that's the thing that sucks.
Yeah. Unless you're the mother of the movement and you're like, guess what? I'm so badass. I'm the first person to have a state funeral and be buried in the Kremlin. And, you know, there were badass women in Russia running the world. And I just want to, you know, kind of tie in. I don't know if you girls saw this, but the Super Bowl is coming up and they always have a flyover over the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
There is a female bomber pilot leading the Super Bowl flyover.
I saw that.
And I think it's incredible. And I can't pronounce her last name. I don't want to like butcher it, but her name, like, she's Captain Sarah, and her last name here, I can't pronounce it, but it's Kocciuba. So don't want to butcher it, because like she's pretty badass herself. But she's a B-2 instructor pilot. She's flown more than 90 combat missions and has more than 1,700 flying hours in 5 different aircrafts, which is very, very impressive as a pilot. And I think, like, we need to give her props for, like, a modern tie-in. Because, you know, even at, like, things like the Super Bowl, that's very male-dominated, you have a woman leading a very patriotic thing. And I think that like speaks volumes. And the most amazing thing that is just incredible with these women is that they were so humble with everything after the war. Like, you ask like women service pilots after, they're like, I was literally just doing my part. That is it.
It's just, it goes back to it. And I will gladly say that I'm a feminist, because this is the time for like, it's feminism is finally getting in play, and it really is because of the women of World War II. Let's be honest. I mean, you could stem it back to Prohibition with the flappers, right? You know, mm-hmm. moving forward, getting outside of the Edwardian, like old school ways of Victorian thinking, Edwardian thinking. However, it just, this really does go to show you that this is the time for women. And yeah. I think it's something that needs to really be taken seriously. I mean, we joke around about with a great meme you wore about the K4s. But I mean, really, like, if you look at that and you look at women who are Chinook pilots or even Black Hawk pilots, they have to be so, they have to be incredibly intelligent to even just be a pilot specifically. Yeah. And they have to have such mental toughness and rigorous to remain calm under those situations. I can only imagine if you were a female pilot or, you know, possibly operator, and you were going into a mission or you were supporting, I don't know, a SEAL team. Like, the risk that you have there, you have to be so even keeled. And I mean, just even put face on, like, because we haven't really talked about I'm trying to enlist. I mean, I basically said on Instagram, it's because, hi, I have kidney stones, which is completely stupid to keep me out, if I'm going to be honest. But when I had tried enlisting, not just Coast Guard, which is extremely selective, but when I was getting ready to even go back and try to do the Army, I had them tell me, you know, now is the opportunity if you want to go into an officer role with a combat armed unit. You have the ability to do so. And I remember sitting there, I was talking to a friend about it, and I remember like weighing my options, and I was like, you know, maybe it's not the time because this is a topic for another day, but sexual assault is so rampant, right, in the military. I was like, you know, maybe that's not the time. But to even have that opportunity for somebody to tell me you could be an officer in this, you know, combat arms unit, you could do it if you wanted to, it's so freaking empowering. Like, even today when I sit there and think about it, and then this is just my personal experience. I mean, on the days where I'm like, man, once again, I'm going into a male-dominated field. Yay, horses. But I sit there and I think about that moment of, like, I'm going to swear, but I'm going to say, fuck this shit. Like, I'm more than capable to do it because of this. I'm like, our ancestors, our grandmothers, our great-grandmothers paved the way for us to do this. And the Night Witches are just freaking feared by the Germans.
Yeah. Come on. I mean, when you get your own medal from the Germans, being like, Germans, if you shoot them down, we'll give you a medal. You're like, that's pretty badass. You're like, you can't shoot me down. They're like, okay, we will literally incentivize you to shoot them down. And they didn't really succeed in that, which is still even more incredible. And I think I had a thought, Alyssa, like while you were talking, I was like, you know, just like even in like going into male dominated fields, like today, like, think about that in like World War II, like my mind instantly went there and was like, that would give you even more like feeling of purpose, more adrenaline rush, more like patriotism, because you are showing them like, yes, I'm a woman. I'm just as patriotic as you. Like, you feel like you have more to prove, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And that was something to go back to that. That was something, you know, when I was weighing the option, I was like, okay, if I can enlist, maybe I will do it. But I was still going to go, first, I was still going to just enlist and get a good footholding, because no one really likes somebody who goes in directly as an officer, to be quite honest, in the military, like commissioned officers right away after you graduate. And so I was like, oh, cryptography. And then I sat there and I was like, male dominated. Okay. I was like, so I just keep picking male dominated fields. And then I was like, okay, well, when I become an officer, I'm going to do military intelligence and do all that. I was like, male dominated. And I just kept thinking about that. And I was like, no, like, that gives me more reason to want to do this and to prove myself, because you guys know me, I would have been able to prove myself, and I would have put my foot down with a lot of things. And it's just one of the things that when you have, and I'll speak on this on my own personal level, but when you have that, I know it sounds so cliche, but the call to serve, like the Night Witches, like the watch, like the last in waves, nothing will stop you. And that is something that when you have that calling, it is one of the things that will literally get you through it. And these women had it. And the fact that other than the Russian counterparts, the Soviet counterparts, they were not recognized like the lost in the waves, just pisses me off beyond all belief, because a lot of them risked their lives. A lot of those who were cryptographers with secretaries as well up in Paris and Holland and Belgium literally risk their lives every single day from getting bombed, from getting exposed. And even just working with the resistance. And these women just did it. But they seem to, I mean, does anybody have final thoughts?
Final thoughts. I love listening to you two talk about, you know, all of this stuff because you're way more knowledgeable about it than I am. But I think that that was honestly something, you know, you're Alyssa, you were just speaking to like going into male dominated fields and kind of making it more so of, it made you more determined. You like, you know, like why should it matter if it's male dominated or not? That's what the Night Witches did. You know, they went in, they faced discrimination. Not from what I could tell, they weren't sabotaged, but they faced discrimination. But that just made them work harder until they became, you know, recognized for being like, oh man, you guys can actually do this. So then they started to get, you know, appreciated more. Not that that's what their end goal was, but they were seen more as equals the better that they got. And then more so to the fact, like once they became christened the Night Witches, they were almost celebrated, which was really awesome. So you see this whole progression of like, nope, they're not allowed to, okay, we'll let you in, but we'll give you all of this, you know, crappy stuff. And then, you know, like, oh wow, you can actually do something with it. Oh my goodness. Wow, you're actually capable. And then, you know, they 22 of them won the Hero of the Soviet Union medal. But the one thing that really sticks out to me, besides, you know, the medals and all of that stuff, is much like, you know, VE Day across all of the Allied countries, the Soviet Union also threw like this massive parade throughout the streets of Moscow to celebrate the end of the war, which the Night Witches were 80 miles from Berlin the day that the war ended. Like, that's how far into Europe they got. They threw a parade complete with like flyovers from fighter pilots who came back from the war. However, the Night Witches were not included because the planes were deemed too slow.
I wonder why, Soviet Russia.
All of this stuff, you know, all of this progressivism and collectivism and, you know, in the communist state. And then it's like, oh, but maybe sit this one out because.
Maybe if we had some faster planes, we'd be able to do the parade. I don't know. I think it's even more important that historians in our generation are keeping these stories alive because literally, if you ask these women, they're like, I legit just did my job. And that's exactly like the same thing that like taking it back to Annie Etheridge, she was like, I just did my job. And like other people were like, no, what you did was incredible. Even though you feel like you just were doing your job, this needs to be celebrated and this needs to be taken to the next level. And so I think it's great that we're giving them the recognition that they deserve, but I think it's great because now more people are going to know about them. They're going to research them more, and it's not going to be a part of dying history.
You make a great point. I think that we need to move women's history outside of literature. Like,
yes.
Women's history makes good novels. We don't teach women's history in you know, grade school, elementary school, high school, things like that. We need to move out of that. There is that interest there for learning about women in history because they did play such a large role. And I think that that's really great that you guys are doing it on this podcast, just because it's another medium to get the information out there. Thank you so, so much for having me. I know that we're trying to wrap this up because it's gone way longer than.
It's going to be amazing. And it's just so important that we have this platform now. Like, once again, thanks to all the badass women who have this. And gave us a way to be able to openly and freely talk about things. Before we head off to and I, when we started planning, we wanted to just, I mean, you know, our podcast is Women on War, but really when we were going through and figuring out our plan and doing all of our talking about what we wanted to do, and I got super pumped about the segment that we're doing, like Women in War, because it is so important. I guess really, attendance-wise, I mean, I know we've talked a lot about women in combat during World War II and what roles that they might have played, but really women played, at least in modern warfare, I will say, their beginnings were in espionage, and which is a huge thing for women, because if they were caught, it wouldn't be a slap on the wrist. It would have been hanging. It would have been penalty. It would have been so many things. And so that leads us to next week. Our next week's episode is going to be on the wonderful Anna Strong. For all of you who have hopefully read the book Turn and not paid attention to AMC's Turn, that it's that Anna Strong, and there is one thing that AMC Turns, because we'll dive into a little bit more, but that Anna Strong, yes, she was filled with espionage, but it's very much fabricated because television. This Anna Strong was impeccable and badass.
Absolutely. And it, and if you watched Turn, Ben Talmadge, she's cute. I'm just gonna like Ben Talmadge, Brewster, I'm like, hang on, looking at all the photos or paintings during the Revolutionary War, there were no men that looked like this. Excuse me? Did you take, like, artistic liberties with this? How do I know I'm not being cat? This is Revolutionary War Tinder. Poor Anna Strong is just fishing through all these men in red coats, just trying to be, like, using her feminine wiles to fish through the Revolutionary War Tinder. I can't. Good Lord. Rachel, such a wealth of knowledge, and I'm so glad that you joined us for our podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time out for episodes 1 and 2. So excited to have you on here. But again, like Alyssa said, Anna Strong next week, and I think we're just gonna like dance our way out of here now. What do you guys think?
Love that idea.